Asian Studies, and it's our great pleasure to bring you this talk today. The co-sponsors for today's talk are the European Union Center for Excellence and also the Moshe Weinstein Center for Jewish Studies, as well as CRECA. Just before I get to today's speaker, I want to mention that next week is our final event of the semester, and that's going to be a colloquium of our MA students presenting on their master's thesis research. So that's next week, May 9th. As for today, today's speaker is Johanna Michlitz, and she is a social and cultural historian and founder and director of the HBI Project on Families, Children, and the Holocaust at Brandeis University. Next fall, she's going to join the faculty in the Department of Historical Studies at Bristol University in the UK. Her major publications include Neighbors Respond and Poland's Threatening Other. In addition to being the editor of the forthcoming volume on Jewish families in Europe, 1939 to the present, History, Representation, and Memory, which is coming out with the University Press of New England and Brandeis University Press in 2014. I also want to note we have flyers in the back, I believe, yes?
Yes.
For another forthcoming publication, Bringing the Dark Past to Light, The Reception of the Holocaust in Post-Communist Europe, edited with an introduction by John Paul Himka, as well as our speaker, Professor Michlitz. So if you're interested, please feel free. There's actually a discount, 20% discount, so it's useful to get the flyer. Our speaker today also is her topic, the titles of her publication suggest. Her current her past research is on the Holocaust in Eastern Europe, and she also has additional projects on the history of rescuers of Jews in East European Jewish childhood in the post-war period. And she's also the recipient of many academic awards and fellowships, I'm afraid too many to name in this short time, but most recently the Fulbright Senior Scholar Award for Haifa University in spring 2013-2014. So please join me in welcoming Professor Johanna Michlitz.
Thank you very much for this very kind introduction. I would like to thank the organizers for bringing me over here. And I would also like to extend special thank you to my old friend and colleague, Halina Filipovic, with whom I first participated at a conference as an MA student quite a few years ago in London at the School of Slavonic Studies. So thanks so much, Halina, for your input and invitation. The book that has been announced, the forthcoming book that we are publishing with my co-author, John Paul Himka, is about the memory of the Holocaust in the entire post-communist Europe. And we deal with this book with all 18 cases from Albania to Ukraine. And of course, this book focuses on the various strategies of dealing with the difficult past, the dark past, in the region today, in the post-communist period, from 1989 or 1991, in the case of the Soviet Union, till the present, looking at various aspects of the memory of the Holocaust and Jews, including grassroots projects, denial of the Holocaust, political and cultural debates, and also artistic representations of the Holocaust and educational projects. What I'm going to do today in my talk, I will link this project with my other project on rescuers of Jews, because as you can imagine, with regards to the dark past, how the nations remember the dark past pertaining to the history of Jews in Eastern Europe, very often the subject of rescuers of Jews is also part of the same debate. And the rescuers are being used in current debates to show the good side of the nations, yes, to prove that we are part of European communities. This is the case of Poland, but as I studied the various cases that I work on for in preparations of this book, Bringing the Dark to Light, I also learned that similar strategies are taking place in Albania. So this is a much more broader phenomenon. But today, when I will be speaking about rescuers in Poland, and just to let you know that the subject of rescuers of Jews has become of great interest, not only to scholars, but also to artists and journalists in Europe, in Western Europe, as well as Eastern Europe. And for example, in England, in the last 3 years, three books were published about rescuers, British rescuers of Jews. Vienna Library launched a new exhibition about rescuers of Jews last year. So we can see that there are some underpinning assumptions, there are some agendas why the rescuers of Jews, the subject has become so important in Europe. One, of course, is an educational, the education of new Europeans and the education for civil society. So the samples of rescuers played a very major role here. Another, but of course, the subject of rescuers, as I mentioned before, is very much embedded in local histories, national histories, and the way the rescuers are treated in each of the countries in Western Europe and Eastern Europe has very much to do with the way rescuers have been treated during the Second World War, during the actions that they did, as well during the communist period. So the aim for my talk today, actually I have two aims. The first one is to debunk the myth of the ungrateful Jew that has crystallized in Poland at the end of the Second World War and definitely throughout the early post-war period and during the communist period, the 50s, and emerged as a full myth in the 1960s. And my second aim is to give you a complicated map of relationship between rescuers and the rescued, the Jewish survivors. So I will be looking at this history through the lenses of microhistory, and will be actually quoting you letters of Jewish survivors as well rescuers from the early post-war period. So I would like to say a few words about the sources that I'm using in this book. So I'm actually analyzing early post-war correspondence addressed to the Central Committee of Polish Jews. This was the umbrella organization for the emerged Jewish communities in Poland. Letters that were also addressed to the American Joint Distribution Committee and to the little-known Warsaw-based Komitet Pomocy Polakom, Committee to Aid the Poles. This committee was the first committee that awarded gifts to the rescuers of Jews. So before Yad Vashem, award for the righteous among Gentiles, this was the first award, and this was very little known committee. The committee was established on the initiative of William Bain. William Bain was the second director of the Warsaw branch of the JOIN. He took his position after the death of David Guzik, who was the first director of the JOIN in Poland, and he, David Guzik, was himself a Polish Jew, a survivor from the Holocaust. William Bain was an American who came after the Second World War to take from the United States to take up this position. The committee began its work on November 15, 1946, and ended its activities, like the join, in late 1949. Basically, in late 1949, the join, as many other Jewish organizations, were recognized as capitalist organizations, as hostile to the communist regimes, and the Stalinist regime put an end to their activities. And the correspondence that actually I'm analyzing today was locked in one of the rooms, which today is the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw, and was only discovered a few years ago. And this correspondence was simply arrested as this was the major archives that we are very fortunate to work with now. What is very interesting, that everybody forgot about that one room in which all the materials that was arrested, the material archives of Join was arrested by the Stalinists. Everybody who worked in the institute has forgotten about it. It was forbidden to look at the acts, at the documents, and only a few years ago a cleaner actually got interested in that room, why this room is not being cleaned. So, and this is how we, sometimes historians, come across amazing, very important documents, primary sources that complicate the stories, the histories that we work on. So the aim of this committee was first to distribute financial aid, food and clothing among rescuers. The committee also had a second aim, to provide Christian holiday greetings and gifts to those rescuers who are known to have provided great service to the Jewish cause. For example, the famous Polish actress Irena Solska, and the famous Polish philosopher Tadeusz Kotarbiński were among such people. The third aim of this committee was to bring rescuers to the public eye, and the last one was to draw up a comprehensive chart of rescue activities by Poles. The latter two aims never came to fruition in early post-war Poland, and of course, if we look closely at the history of anti-Semitism and accompanied hostile attitudes towards rescuers at the time in Poland, we realized that this at the time wasn't possible at all. These large and unique collections of letters, petitions, and accompanying notes written between late 1944 and 1949 is scattered among different sections of the archives of the Central Committee of Polish Jews at the Institute, at the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw, as I mentioned before. Its authors were Christian, or not only Catholic, but not only, socialist, ethnic Polish rescuers, rescued Jewish survivors, both adults and older children, and relatives of Jewish survivors living in or outside of Poland. Some of the letters came from Palestine, Israel. Some of the letters came from the United States. The importance of this scarcely investigated correspondence lies in its conveying of rarely heard voices of both rescuers and rescued Jews, with the latter corroborating the recollections of the former rescuers and in some cases elaborating on their savior's good deeds. As you can imagine, sometimes the gap, social and educational gap between the rescuers coming from the countryside and the Jewish survivors was huge. And therefore, we will find much more information about the predicaments of rescue activities in the letters of the Jewish survivors than in the accounts given by the rescuers. The presence of such concerted recollections enable us to infer that these letters contain evidence offering new insights into the rescue activities and the relationship between rescuers and Jewish survivors during and after the war. A large number of the rescuers, both the authors of their own letters and those individuals referred to in the letters of Jewish survivors, constitute a group of what I call dedicated individuals committed to saving Jewish fugitives regardless of the dangers and without any prior assurance of reward or any intention to profit from human misfortune. This group stands out in the sharp contrast to the group of so-called rescuers for profit and those other individuals who ruthlessly took advantage of Jewish fugitives by abandoning, denouncing, and even murdering their former charges. And only today, thanks to the opening of archives, various archives in Eastern Europe, we can actually draw a typology, a full typology of rescuers. So we have the dedicated rescuers, but we also have rescuers for profit, and we also have rescuers who in the course of the war became perpetrators of the former Jewish charges, or rescuers who, for example, saved some Jews from the same families but killed others. So the map of rescue in the light of present knowledge has become very complicated. It's a very different story from what we have known before. Jewish survivors wrote letters about the rescuers either on their own initiative or because the rescuers asked them to do so. Some former Jewish charges, including children, encouraged their former rescuers to apply for recompense to the Central Committee of Polish Jews for what they had selflessly done for them during the war. For example, in her letter of January 20th, 1947, written in the Jewish children's home in Szydłów, that's central Poland, Jewish children's home became to mushroom in Poland in early post-war period, especially in central Poland. So Szydłów and Otwock are perhaps the most known Jewish children's home located in central Poland. And Jewish child survivors were brought to these children's homes or came on their own accord. That story of a Jewish children's home is a very complicated one. But here is a case of Esterka Wasenstein. And in her letter that she wrote from the Jewish children's home, she urged her rescuer, Maria Sitkowska, from the village of Sitno, 70 kilometers north of Warsaw, to immediately turn to Jewish organizations for financial assistance, since she is not sure how long such assistance might be available. In her letter, she addresses Mrs. Sitkowska as Mother, and I cite, "Dear Mommy, I'm writing to advise you that you should go to Warsaw to our committee where you will get several thousand zlotys for bringing me up. Those who sheltered the Jews have received payments from the committee, and I would like you to receive it too for all that you did for me. The committee is located in Warsaw at number 60 Sienna Street. There you can inquire about the reward. Do not waste this opportunity because later you might not be offered anything. When you get to Warsaw, you should tell them that you hid me, Esterka Wasenstein, and that my Polish name was Stefcia Zakrzewska. I hope you have not forgotten me." The end of quote. Mrs. Sitkowska had found Esterka in 1941, sometimes in the fall of 1941, and had arranged of her own accord and at her own expense a false birth certificate for the girl in the name of Stefania Zakrzewska. Of course, as you recognize, this was her ticket for survival, ticket to life. In spite of having a large family of her own, Sitkowska looked after Esterka for 5 years as if she were her own daughter. during the Nazi occupation, she regularly cut the girls' hair very, very short, so no one would suspect her of being Jewish. And the girl had black curly hair, and this was, of course, a physical attribute that other neighbors could easily recognize as being Jewish. The black curly hair or red hair, they were the physical attributes associated with Jews, and this is why many of the Jewish fugitives had to go completely under, were totally hidden because of the what was considered at the time the bad physical look. By 1947, Sitkowska was a widow, taking care of her own six biological children. So that actually shows you actually the dedication of this woman. As with other correspondents, the letters of Jewish charges requesting support for the rescuers vary in length. Some are brief statements of a single page accompanied by a signature, while others are more lengthy and elaborated. Many of these letters give the impression of being composed in a hurry en route to beginning a new life, or of already having gone away to live in a faraway place. Nonetheless, the authors of these letters feel obliged to make official statements in support of their former rescuers. Their preoccupation with the relocation and search for their own families in Poland and abroad do not stop them from maintaining some form of contact with their former rescuers. This indicates that among many survivors, there was a consensus that those who had risked their lives on their behalf and who had not used or abused them in any way should be acknowledged and their kindness repaid with kindness. The survivors felt compelled to act accordingly to the traditional Jewish concept of mitzvah, goreret mitzvah, a good deed leads to another good deed. Dire poverty and lack of basic goods and supplies were quite widespread among both Poles and remnants of Polish Jews in the immediate post-war period. Those who came from destroyed cities such as Warsaw and those who were resettled in western and central parts of Poland as repatriates from the Kresy, the eastern Polish territories that were taken over by the Soviet Union, seemed the most destitute. In the ruins of Warsaw, young and old had to begin their lives from zero. The language in which the rescuers describe their life conditions reveals the sheer level of poverty and destruction. I'm naked and barefoot. I'm totally burned. They are the statements that many of the rescuers use to describe their situation, their condition. The Jewish survivors generally recognized that the rescuers, many of whom were widows of varying ages, and women, sole breadwinners of families, were in urgent need of material assistance. Therefore, in their petitions, they paid special attention to descriptions of the wartime predicaments and significance of the rescuers' actions, and highlight the selfless dedication and commitment of the rescuers. They also take care to convey the drastic current material, medical, and social situation of their former rescuers. Not infrequently, they also suggest specific forms of remuneration for the rescuer, such as food, clothing, underwear, and financial payments, similar to the assistance they themselves had received from the Department of Social Welfare of the Central Committee of Polish Jews and the Joint. The characteristic portrait of the dedicated rescuer that emerges from the former Jewish charges letters is that of an exceptional individual who had extended help not only to one, but to many Jewish fugitives, and who had provided more than just one form of assistance. The list of activities which can be classified as part of the rescue effort is long and includes smuggling food into the ghetto, smuggling Jews out of the ghetto, preparing, delivering, and paying for false documents, sheltering, feeding, washing, and cleaning. That was especially important for children. And in the early post-war recollections of child Holocaust survivors, children speak in great length about the way they were taken care of by the rescuers. Another form of rescue was safeguarding precious belongings, curtailing blackmail, sending postcards, letters, and packages as a proof of Christian Polish identity of the Jewish charges who had been forced to relocate or who had been taken to prison or concentration camps as Christian Poles. And the last one, being a messenger between Jews in hiding on the Aryan side and handling their personal and business affairs. As a rule, such rescuers had acted with the cooperation of only very few members of their own immediate family, such as a spouse or a child, or may even have acted entirely on their own. And this is one of my main arguments in this book on rescuers that I'm working on. And I oppose the position of Gunnar Paulsen. You might have heard about his book, Secret City. In this book, Gunnar Paulsen claims that many saved a few. The close analysis of the letters and other testimonies of Jewish charges and rescuers actually shows that a few saved many. And now I will be giving you some of the more detailed examples from letters. In the letter of March 11, 1947, three survivors, Hela and Nathan Rokacz and Malcolm Ruth Podemska, stressed the compassionate attitude of the rescuers as the main reason they had been able to survive the war. The Wiśniewski couple had sheltered Hela and Nathan Rokacz, along with their two children and Malcolm Ruth Podemska, in the Warsaw apartment on Emily Platter Street number 8. From April 20th, 1943, so this is one day after the beginning of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, till January 17, 1945. The survivors highlight the fact that Wiśniewskis had also sheltered two of their other relatives, who, like them, were fugitives from the Warsaw Ghetto. The other two had already left Poland and therefore could not be included as the eyewitnesses to the good deeds performed by Wiśniewskis or included with the co-authors of the letter that states, and I cite, "These people, the Wiśniewski couple, shared all the meager food that they had with us, and throughout the entire time exhibited a compassionate attitude towards us, and thanks to that we managed to survive the occupation. After we left the ghetto, these people made false documents for us, for which they paid with their own money. At present, the Wiśniewskis are in a dire situation because Mr. Wiśniewski returned from German captivity only a month ago and because everything they had was destroyed in the uprising, the Warsaw uprising of August 1944. Because of that, we would like to request that the Wiśniewskis receive temporary assistance in the form of money, food, and clothes." The end of quote. In her letter of September 23, 1945, Mrs. Mintsova, a survivor, describes her rescuer, Mr. Tarczyński, as a kind and dedicated man. Tarczyński sheltered Mintsova along with Dr. Balbina Montreal and her three-year-old daughter for 2 years in his home with his wife and two young daughters. In addition, Mintsova informs the Central Committee of Polish Jews that Tarczyński sheltered four members of another family. Mintsova wrote the letter in September 1945 while she was still living with the Tarczyńskis. Remaining for some time after the war with a rescuer wasn't unusual in the case of children and younger and older women who had lost their families, entire families. However, one can make certain distinctions between child and adult survivors who continued living for some time with the rescuers after the war. While some children, especially older Jewish children, didn't wish to return to the Jews because of the Nazi anti-Jewish genocidal policy, your own personal wartime experiences, and the loving and supportive family relations with the Christian rescuers, other children, especially those living in the countryside, had not yet been informed that the war was over, nor that they were Jewish, and therefore they were not able to make fully informed and autonomous decisions pertaining to their departure straight away. However, adult women survivors who remain with the rescuers, they remain for four main reasons. They had no surviving family members, were uncertain of their future plans, and that was the case especially with older women, had forged strong emotional bonds with the rescuers, or had forged romantic ties with their saviors, and they subsequently got married and left Poland in the early post-war period, many of such couples. Now, to give you an example of a young survivor and the way she describes her rescuers. Hinda Zaboklicka was still living with her rescuers in March 1947 in the village of Złotokłos, 15 kilometers south of Warsaw. She writes a deeply moving letter about the Salicy's acts of selfless devotion, both towards her and towards another unidentified member of her family. The Salicy were her pre-war teachers. In late 1942, they smuggled Hinda from the Kałuszyn ghetto, 28 kilometers north of Warsaw, and brought her to their home. Given the descriptions of the weather conditions and other details in Hilda's letter, this most likely occurred after November 25, 1942, when the first deportations of the 3,000 Jews of Kałuszyn to Treblinka, including Hilda's parents, had taken place. And the Salicy were not afraid to keep her throughout the rest of the German occupation, despite pressure from their neighbors to get rid of the Jews. And in fact, they also got her a false identity card in the name of Sabina Jabłońska. And in this letter to the Central Committee of Polish Jews, she uses both her original Jewish name and the acquired Aryan name. And this is not an atypical situation, and many child survivors, as well as adult survivors, continue to live with their acquired Aryan name after the Second World War. They did not return to their original Jewish names. So this is a quote from her letter. "I must stress that they walked on foot about 30 kilometers to Kałuszyn in rain and in snow, and they searched for us all over our village. They made such a sacrifice as if we were their closest family. They took us home, ignoring the danger to their own lives, and they shared everything they had with us. They treated us as if we were their family, completely selfless, since we didn't possess anything except for our misfortune. They kept us and tried to provide us with everything in spite of the testing conditions. Mr. Salicy refused to work for the Germans because he didn't want to have anything to do with them. He hated them like we did. People from the area were saying that he was hiding Jews. I walked freely within their property, but the Salicy stated that God's will is stronger than that of the murderers and didn't give us up. I wish I were able to repay even just a tiny part for saving my life in such difficult times when they could have been killed at any moment. Only a biological mother is capable of such acts, but here, as complete strangers, they had acted just as selflessly." The end of quote. Similarly, Ruja Stettner and A. Finkelstein wrote a passionate letter detailing the various rescue activities of the lawyer, Grażyna Sznurtowa, who conducted most of her rescue action in the small town of Legionowo, located 23 kilometers northeast of Warsaw, where she lived until the Warsaw Uprising of August 1944. And it is interesting that actually studying these letters, the areas that they come from, we actually can also draw a map of rescue, the main centers of rescue, the towns and outside of Warsaw, the towns and villages. These two survivors took upon themselves the recording of Szmultowe's good deeds, extended not only to them and their families, but also to other Jews. Thus, they write both as individuals and as representatives of that entire group of survivors whom Szmultowe rescued. According to the letter of September 28, 1946, she emerges as a selfless, altruistic, and compassionate individual who assisted many Jews in many ways. Interestingly, she declined to accept any financial help from the Jewish organizations after the war, accepting only two supplies of clothes, two towels, two blankets, and three tubes of toothpaste for her family. This is how the survivors describe her. Mrs. Szmultowe belongs to that group of individuals of Aryan origin who helped the Jews by ignoring all the rules and orders of the Nazi occupier, risking her own life and the lives of her family. Her home was open to the people from the ghetto. She safeguarded the remnants of the belongings of the miserable ones, which allowed many to save themselves from the clothes of their tormentors. And of course, here the reference is to the blackmailers on the Aryan side. She gave shelter for 2 weeks to Jean Lanier, a Jew from Avignon and a soldier of the French army. He subsequently went off and returned back to her home on many occasions. She kept him and fed him generously. Szmultowe also helped Regina Wiśniewicz, who now lives at Zachodnia Street in Łódź. Łódź, the third largest city in Poland, was the main center of Jewish life in early post-war period, and for a short period was also the capital of Poland. She hosted my old mother and sister in her home for a long time without asking them for any payment. She fed them and carefully hid them from the eyes of her neighbors in one of the buildings belonging to her property. However, after a few visits from the gendarmerie, when it became too dangerous for them to remain there, she found them a shelter in Warsaw, where the family subsequently remained. She did a lot of good things for Róża Stetna and her daughter by placing both of them in the homes of friends of hers who lived in the countryside. Today, Mrs. Szmultowe is completely destroyed by the war and has to support her old aunt and her own two daughters who are still at school. We would like the directors of the Central Committee of Polish Jews, who always relate to such matters positively, to help Mrs. Szmultowe and her family by supplying them with clothes that are so hard to obtain these days. In this way, the Jews whom she has sheltered will be able to repay her, at least in part, for what she did for them. The end of quote. On March 31st, 1947, 10 Jewish survivors from Sosnowiec and Katowice in South Poland wrote a collective letter to the Central Committee of Polish Jews in Warsaw asking for support, reward, and protection of the wartime savior Leon Bukowinski from Warsaw. They call him a sincere patriot who provided indispensable help to people of different religious background. Bukowinski, an educated middle-class man with a wife and two sons, belonged to the Polish underground in occupied Warsaw. His position in the Polish police, Granatowa Policja, gave him that rare opportunity to perform rescue activities that ordinary civilians had no chance to succeed at. As the letter informs, Bukowinski issued false documents, relocated many Jews from dangerous hiding places, the places that were called in Polish spalone, burned, to new safe shelters, warned Jews on the Aryan side about blackmailers, and frequently shut down circles of blackmails. And I will give you a quote from that letter that is actually a list of people whom Bukovinsky helped. And this is, as a matter of fact, as I discovered by studying other sources, this is not a complete list of individuals whom Bukovinsky helped. We cite names of individuals who we know personally whom Bukovinsky helped. Marian Borkowski von Bernstein, his wife and two-year-old child, lived in the Bukovinsky's family home between August 1942 and the entry of the Soviet army into the city, January 1945. Ruchla Glukli, he curtailed blackmail. Wolf Belinsky, risking his life, he carefully prepared and executed escape from Pavyak prison. Pavyak prison was the notorious prison in Warsaw, from which the majority of prisoners, both ethnic Poles and Polish Jews, did not return alive. Another person, Liberova and her son, he defended them from blackmailers while smuggling them to Praga, neighborhood of Warsaw. He had to use a weapon against the blackmailers at Washington Avenue. The Iger family from Sosnowitz, numbering eight persons. He found a safe shelter for all of them at Korawa Street in Warsaw. Jasiński and Mirosława Poznańska and her husband, he transported these three persons from Częstochowa to Warsaw. Felix Rockman, lawyer, and his brother Stanisław with wife, he protected them against blackmail. The Bobe family from Ostrołęka, he assisted them and took a special care of an eight-year-old child whose parents had perished. In a testimony given by another child survivor, I realized that this child survivor was also speaking about Bukovinsky. The child survivor was called by members of the Granatowa Policja, Polish police, and was questioned, and the policeman realized that he was a Jewish child and wanted to take him to the Germans. And Bukovinsky emerged at this moment at that particular station and shamed those men, his colleagues, and as a result, this child survived the war. In some cases, the survivors had lost touch with their saviors during the Warsaw Uprising of August 1944 or at the end of the war, and sought them out later in order to thank and repay them for their wartime deeds. For example, Ludwig Opal felt compelled to find out the whereabouts of a Polish medical doctor who had saved his life. In his letter of April 9, 1947, Opal describes the dedication of the doctor in curing him of life-threatening injuries and of ensuing complications from his wounds. Opal and his wife, luckily, escaped from the death train going from the Warsaw Ghetto to Treblinka, but both were injured and needed shelter and urgent medical help. They found their first safe shelter at the building of an institution in Grochów on the outskirts of Warsaw, in which Opal had worked for 20 years before the war. So the caretaker of the building recognized him and took them in. Opal was fortunate to find medical assistance through a former colleague who was informed by the caretaker of the building about Opal being there in hiding. And this former colleague organized a doctor, Mr. Guy, who agreed beforehand to help the injured Jew who might otherwise die. He instantly conducted an operation on Opal's head and continued to monitor him over the next several months in a new hiding place in Warsaw, where Opal was forced to relocate after blackmailers had sniffed him out in Grochów. This is how Opal speaks about his savior, and I cite, "The doctor was not afraid of taking responsibility for my well-being. After he found out my new address, he visited me for several months, bringing me bandages and various medications. I want to emphasize that during this entire period, The doctor didn't take a penny from me, neither for the operation nor for the medication. Needless to say, this doctor saved my life. I have not been in touch with him since that time, but I have just learned that he lives in Łódź. I believe that my duty is to show gratitude to him. He deserves to be recompensed because of his noble actions. Therefore, I kindly ask the commission to reward the doctor with a sum of money. I leave it up to the commission to decide on the amount of the sum for his selfless rescue of a Jew from an otherwise inevitable death under most dangerous circumstances. The end of quote. Some survivors who had already moved abroad and were either waiting in DP camps in Germany to travel to their final destinations, the new homeland, or already engaged in building a new life overseas, also wrote letters to the Central Committee of Polish Jews, delineating how they had been rescued and requesting material assistance for the former rescuers. Some of these survivors also asked for personal loans from the Central Committee of Polish Jews that could be directly given to the rescuers. And I will give you one example of such case. For example, Dr. Sarah Spiegel wrote a very moving letter in May 1947 from her comfortable new home on New York's Upper West Side. In the letter, she praises her rescuer, Marian Wrubel. Wrubel, a Varsovian like herself, was both her former pre-war patient and pre-war friend of her husband. In the letter, Spiegel briefly relates the circumstances in which she met Wrubel in Warsaw after she had escaped the Warsaw ghetto in early 1943. On May 3rd, 1943, so this is during the Warsaw ghetto uprising, she was forced to leave her previous shelter at the apartment of other Christian friends. She found herself on the street, fearful and without the slightest idea of whom to turn to for help. But she sadly remembered Wrubel and made a quick decision to approach him for help. And Spiegel stresses that Wrubel took her in without hesitation and in despite of his difficult marital and family circumstances and their dire wartime conditions. And actually, he sheltered her in his apartment for 14 months until July 1944. And she emphasizes in the letter, for all his efforts and worries, Wrubel didn't ask, nor he did receive any recompense in money or other material form from me, except for my gratitude at his noble actions in saving my life. At present, I'm in communications via letters with Mr. Wrubel, and I'm aware that his material situation is bad. If the Central Committee of Polish Jews in Warsaw compensates this kind of individual who contributed to saving the Jews from the Nazi destructions, then Mr. Marian Wrubel of Bolechowa Street in Warsaw should be enlisted as one of the most deserving people. He should be offered material help. The end of quote. It wasn't only adults, but also Jewish youngsters, teenagers, and children as young as 7, 8 years old who remain in contact with their dedicated rescuers after the war. The children who were aware who they were, I'm talking in the case of all the children I'm talking here about, speaking here about. Some rescuers asked these young Jewish survivors to assist them to get help because of disastrous events that had befallen them after the war, all because of the difficulty in coping with the dire early post-war economic conditions, all because their belongings, their properties were damaged by those who disapproved of their rescue activities, by their neighbors and other members of the local communities. And like the adult survivors, the young survivors take pains to emphasize that the rescuers were kind and selfless individuals who didn't take advantage of them or exploit them in any way. Such evaluations of rescuers by young survivors suggest that they were capable of grasping on both cognitive and psychological, we can also argue mental levels, the differences between various types of rescuers and other individuals with whom they had come into contact during the course of the war. And I will give you here an example of one, or two examples. One is of Shmuel Shaiko, who was born in Warsaw on February 17, 1927. He found refuge in the home of a farmer, Franciszek Stokowski, in the village of Krzeczków in Białystok province in north part of Poland, after he had escaped Warsaw Ghetto in late 1942. Shaiko was luckily reunited with his aunt, Mrs. Nowodworska, who returned as a repatriate from the Soviet Union in 1946, but nevertheless he had continued to keep in touch with Stokowski. And in one of his letters to the Central Committee of Polish Jews, this is what he states. "I have to acknowledge that they treated me very well and didn't exploit me in any way. They behaved towards me in such a way as to lessen the pain I had felt after the loss of my parents. In 1943, they arranged a false identity card for me in the name of Władysław Staszewski, so I could feel safer, and they risked their own lives in the process." The end of quote. In a short and highly dramatized early post-war memoir of the Nazi occupation, Alexander Minakier, another Warsaw Jewish boy, underscores how his rescuers and the family of rescuers acted for selfless reasons. Alexander had lost his parents in the Warsaw Ghetto when he was 13. He succeeded in escaping the ghetto in early April 1943, just on the eve of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, and reached his rescuers soon after. They treated him as if he were their own child. What we do not learn from his memoir, but we learn from the letter of Mariana Sikorska, the head of the family of the rescuers, is the fact that before the war, the Sikorskis and Alexander Minakier's parents were not only neighbors living in the same building, but also friends. Not only did their friendship endure during the war, but in fact survived the hardest test. After the Minakier family was forced to relocate to the Warsaw Ghetto, Sikorska used to smuggle food supplies to them. Alexander Minakier was about the same age as Sikorska's two children, and she felt compelled to save him when he arrived at their home in a pitiful state 2 weeks before the outbreak of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. And we have similar accounts also coming from relatives of the Jewish survivors, the parents, in the case of child survivors. Here is a short excerpt from the letter of Anna Batskova, the mother of a girl, Diana, who was born in 1934, and she was looked after during the war by an elderly couple, Stanisław and Władysław Zbysz. The girl had arrived at the Warsaw apartment in October 1943, where she remained until the end of the Warsaw uprising of August 1944. And I quote, "She, Stanisława Zbysz, looked after the child very well and acted out of selfless motives. Since I was in a terrible material situation and could not pay her, at present, Stanisława Zbysz and her husband, both in their 70s, live in poverty because the husband suffers badly from severe asthma. Therefore, I'm asking for assistance for them with clothes, food, and financial help." And here's an excerpt from a letter written by a sister of two Jewish survivors, and she herself was later also rescued by the same woman. In her letter of April 14, 1947, Helena Arkin-Okońska, the sister of Artur and Viktor Arkin, praises Agnieszka Wrubel, a young, middle-class woman, thanks to whom both brothers found shelters and survived on the Aryan side in Warsaw. Wrubel was a messenger between the Warsaw Ghetto and the Aryan side. She was also involved in the underground, the Polish underground, and smuggled food to the ghetto. Helena Arkin-Okońska elaborates events and conditions under which Wrubel conducted rescue activities, which the rescuer briefly touches upon in her own letter, very modest letter, to the Central Committee of Polish Jews. So it's not only the educational and social background, but sometimes the personality also of the rescuer that impacts on the length of the letters, on giving the details of the predicaments, the hardships, etc., etc. From Helena Arkin's letter, we learn that Wrubel was blackmailed many times over while delivering food to Arthur Arkin in his shelter on the Aryan side. The blackmailer, another Polish woman, Stefania Damowa, of 18 Nowogrodzka Street, also blackmailed Viktor Arkin, who was hiding at Agnieszka Wrubel's apartment. After the Warsaw Uprising, Wrubel took her Jewish charges to her sister's home in Limanowa in the Beskidy Mountains in the south of Poland, where she also offered shelter to two other Jews, Helena Arkin-Okońska and Bronisław Ludo. Jewish survivors and rescuers often recall blackmail as the ominous daily challenge that they had to fight. In addition, young Jewish women fugitives and their dedicated female rescuers, including all the Polish women, recall struggling not only with financial blackmail, but also with attempts at sexual assaults. Now, to conclude, Noe Gruss, one of the leading historians of the Jewish Historical Commission, set up in Poland in November 1944, viewed accounts concerning rescue activities as the files of innate human kindness in the archives, primarily registering the murder and destruction of individuals, families, and entire generations. While these letters undoubtedly corroborate acts of kindness and dedication, they also constitute rare and salient material for the study of the intricate map of wartime relations between Polish rescuers and rescued Jews, and into their surrounding local neighborhoods and communities. The portrait of the selfless dedicated rescuer that emerges from the letters of Jewish survivors, their relatives and members of Jewish organizations, is on one hand fairly uniform. The selfless rescuer, both in and outside of Warsaw, is usually an individual, female or male, who extended rescue activities out on several rather than just a single Jewish fugitive, and who provided several forms of assistance, such as sheltering and feeding Jewish fugitives, finding them shelters in other people's homes when necessary, safeguarding their belongings, arranging false papers, assisting in providing their Christians Polish identities, and transporting them from one hiding place to another. Neighbors and professional blackmailers frequently harassed the selfless rescuer. Nevertheless, such a rescuer typically managed to stand up to social pressures, fear, and threats of denunciation, and continue to engage in rescue activities. This corroborates the thesis first raised in Dzieci Żydowskie Oskarżają, The Children Accused, published in 1946 by Maria Hochberg-Mariańska and Noah Gruss, of a low societal approval of rescue activities directed at Jews in Poland. On the other hand, the portrait of the selfless rescuer is varied with regard to the social and professional background, gender, age, and marital status. Many selfless rescuers are pre-war friends of Jewish charges and their families, and are individuals with a pre-war history of professional and social relations with Jews. Many are women who are either widows or sole family breadwinners. Also, single women are a very important group of rescuers of Jewish children. What emerges on the whole is that the dedicated rescuer is a special individual who, in his or her relations with the Jewish fugitives, transcends ethnic and religious boundaries. He, she, L clearly stands out from the community to which he, she belongs and appears to be a minority driven by a set of qualities and values atypical to that community. This picture is confirmed in survivors' and rescuers' testimonies of the same and later period. Thank you very much.